It would be kind of, I guess, in keeping with what we've been discussing tonight. First of all, David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Art, for having me on again.
Happy to have you. It's kind of an interesting discussion tonight, David. I talked with Bob White for an hour, who had an amazing sighting and actually has an artifact from that sighting. And even before I had him on, I was sort of, I don't know, I guess reminiscing that I was a skeptic at one time. Until it happened to me twice.
Yeah.
And that changes you for life. And I know there are a lot of people in our audience tonight that have never had a sighting. They've never seen a disc or a UFO or whatever. They never have. And they're probably pretty skeptical. Well, Bob's life changed. My life changed. Obviously, as I just read in 1968, your life changed. Apparently forever, or at least through this moment. What happened to you in 1968?
Well, it's actually quite amazing because in 1967, 68, I was born in 61 in Berkeley, California. Walking home from school, we used to be, you know, Star Trek fans back then, and my brothers and I were all gang up and watch Star Trek after school. And we used to drop pennies, my friend Tommy and I, down the manhole to hit the guy on the head with the, you know, the orange hard hat. He would come running up screaming after us, and we would hide. I remember dropping the penny, hitting the guy in the head, and when he came up, we were running, and we noticed everyone's looking at this metallic disc shining in the sky, and everyone came out of the manhole. The whole street was packed, and I remember people knocking on their neighbors' doors. And there's this shiny, metallic, you know, shimmering UFO, and we thought, oh, it's the Starship Enterprise.
Huh.
And, you know, when we got home and I told my father and my mother what I had seen that day, it was like, no, those things don't really exist. I mean, that's just a TV show. But I had a series of dreams, repeated dreams of one set of multicolor lights spinning one way and one spinning the other way, the opposite direction, on the same axis. And what's interesting about the dream is many years later, as actually in the 1970s, three physicists, Bardeen, Cooper, and Schaefer, won the Nobel Prize for what is known as Cooper's pairs. And they spin electron pairs in opposite directions on the same axis, and they get superconductivity, the ultimate state of conquering, you know, inertia and resistance. So there had to be some meaning to the dream, and there was the answer, you know, many years later.
But you had an unqualified experience, not a dream. You actually...
No, I saw the UFO. It was the dreams that followed the experience of seeing the UFO.
So as a kid, you dropped pennies on workers.
Yeah,
for fun.
For fun, yeah. I remember him getting so pissed off. I thought, oh, if he catches us, he's going to kill us.
Well, all right. So you grew up to be an adult. researching UFOs, and you turned from wanting to be an astronaut. That was, I guess, very early, huh?
Well, actually, at that time, my stepfather, Dave Cooper, was a science teacher, and I was collecting scrap missions of every Apollo mission there was and just dreaming about going into space. And I really believed. In fact, I remember one day eating lunch at a restaurant in Vancouver, Canada, and this man just standing up out of the blue and tapping me on the shoulder. I've never seen him before in my life, and he says, excuse me, sir, but I see you as an astronaut in your future. And then he went and sat back down. And I thought, oh, my God, maybe I'm really going to make it, or I'm going to get abducted one day. I don't know what, one of the two.
So now as an adult, would you regard yourself as, I guess, a ufologist, huh?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I have been able to be in the company of some of the greatest physicists of our time, working on nuclear fusion and working on hydrogen breakthrough technologies and a lot of high-tech stuff, including bomb detection for major physicists. And I was able to be a fly on the wall theoretical physicist for years in front of people like, you know, Bogdan Magwitch, Murray Gell-Mann, Norman Rostocker, Glenn Seaborg, who chaired the Atomic Energy Commission.
Well, how did your belief in ufology get you next to these guys?
Well, I kind of keep it secret. I mean, in fact, even today in the hallway, I bumped into a UCLA physicist, Jim Roseborough, who's a professor of physics at UCLA, and he said, I don't believe in UFOs. In fact, technically, they're not even allowed to believe in UFOs because they just get laughed at.
Oh, yes.
And maybe in secret, a lot of them do. In fact, you end up finding out when they retire. they're very interested. But while they're in office, in fact, I remember sending Murray Gell-Mann, the 1962 Nobel Prize winner in physics, who is said to be the greatest scientist since Einstein by many physicists today, discoverer of quarks and all these subatomic particles.
Yes.
And I worked with him, you know, he was in the company of the physicists I worked for in fusion. And when I sent him the tape on the NASA UFOs, he was really upset.
I mean, well, I still am unable to grasp how your work in ufology got you next to these guys, or were you legitimately working in...
No, I was legitimately working for them, and they didn't know about my interest in UFOs. I was working for them trying to do, like, Bogdan Castle-Magwitch had developed a nuclear fusion device using helium-3 and deuterium, which is far beyond cold fusion, far beyond tritium fusion. And then I met all of these guys. I met the head of the Russian space program at the time.
You were working as a, would you characterize yourself as a scientist or a scientific, perhaps some sort of scientific assistant? Where would you put yourself?
Well, where I was is I got a letter one day from John Bryson, who just took over Southern California Edison. He's an ex-environmentalist who becomes the new CEO of Edison. And Edison decided to invite me to bring in all these alternative energy scientists. This is back in late 80s. And I read about Bogdan Magwitch. There was an article called Bogdan Magwitch Knows How to Make Non-Radioactive Nuclear Power, So Why Isn't He? In the Omni 9th, February 87 issue. And I phoned him up and I said, you know, the president of Edison wants to meet you. So I met Magwitch on the steps of Edison. That would be 1987, 88. And I thought it was going to be a slam dunk. I thought this guy had scores of Nobel laureates supporting his work. He had already funded three prototype models. In 1987, the Air Force at Kirtland in New Mexico just finished feasibility studies on Super Cray 2s to find out if the next stage would achieve beyond break-even fusion using helium-3 fuel. And helium-3 fuel is so energetic, Art, 9 grams of helium-3 can produce the energy of 1,000 barrels of crude oil. It is far more energetic than cold fusion. I'll give you an example. Just so you
is this a hot fusion process?
It's hot fusion. In fact, there are people who don't even believe, and I've talked to many, in fact, I talked to Seaborg about cold fusion. Seaborg was the head of the AEC and, of course, responsible for all the nuclear testing in Nevada. He said he didn't believe it was fusion. He said it was some sort of a chemical reaction that was causing the heat, and then they convert the heat to energy.
A hot fusion reaction producing what kind of temperatures?
You're not going to believe this, but let me
try me.
Okay, 10 billion degrees with no heat radiating out of the reactor.
10 billion degrees. All right. Isn't there a problem in containing something that produces that kind of heat?
That's the first reaction that everybody says. So to give a comparative model, the government fusion reactor at Princeton, which is tokamak fusion, they fuse deuterium and tritium, and they get about 100 million degrees, and they have a lot of problems containing the temperature.
Okay, well, I'm asking that question.
Yeah.
If you produce something of that temperature, how do you contain it?
Here's how it's done. The genius of Magwitch was that he built a self-colliding beam magnetic field that every time the heat or energy tries to radiate out, the magnetic field keeps throwing it back into the center. That's why it gets so intensely concentrated in the center of the device, and he was able to clobber tokamak fusion in temperatures. You need a billion to fuse helium-3. You need 100.
All right, just a speculative question,
yeah,
David, but if you had a fusion reaction of this magnitude going on, and unlike a conventional reactor, you have a water problem, you've got a little fudge time in there to correct things, but it seems to me if you lost your magnetic field, it would be very unpleasant.
Well, that's what it seems
wouldn't like. Wouldn't that be a problem?
No, in this case it wouldn't be. In fact, it's very safe, and I'll explain why. Most nuclear reactions, including slow fission of uranium, you're basically taking energy in the form of heat and boiling water. And water, of course, you get pressure on pipes, and there's a lot of, you know, coarse radiation.
Right.
Slow fission of uranium produces 200 million electron volts per fission, and you lose 60% of that by the time you convert your thermal conversion from heat back into electricity because you're boiling water and turning turbines.
Sure.
Cold fusion, deuterium produces 3.67 MeV, which is a fraction of that, and you lose 60% again because it's a heat thermal conversion, which leaves you with about 1.2 MeV. Now, helium-3 fusion is benign. There's no heat conversion. It produces all charged particles that convert directly into electricity, cutting out or obviating the heat cycle and making it much more efficient. And plus...
So you're saying there is no heat cycle?
There's no heat cycle.
No heat cycle. And he had working.
He had three models developed working, and then the Air Force at Kirtland did tests for the final model on Super Cray 2s to simulate the reaction.
Yes.
And the results were classified, described as groundbreaking work on fusion power, which I had access to those reports. The reports were so stunning, they said there was no reason, no instabilities. They would attain beyond break even. 1 square meter would produce a gigawatt. That's a full-scale nuclear module, 1 gigawatt, a billion watts in a square meter, and 9 grams of the fuel, which you can hold in your left hand, and that'll produce the energy of 1,000 barrels of crude oil. So,
all right, so what happened to this device? I mean, they confirm it virtually on a Cray computer, and then what?
Then what happens is James Fletcher, who's head of NASA in the late 80s, and Earl Van Lanningham, whom I've had very long conversations with about fusion and UFOs, he was head of propulsion, power, and energy at NASA, and they were begging for this thing. They were like, the space station has these solar panels up there. They have very, what are in terms of, you know, doing high energy experimentation in space, they have a very small amount of power on the space station. They
right.
would love to have a lot more. They would love to have a gigawatt.
Of course.
They're nowhere near that. They're in the 100 megawatt range, you know, down in that range right now. So a gigawatt is a dream. And further, Van Lanningham said that you could use the reactor and you could open a iris, open and closing iris at the back of the reactor, and he said 18 MeV protons, that's 18 million electron volt protons, could, as an anti-proton propulsion system, could send spacecraft up to 1/10 the speed of light, which is 67 million miles an hour. And today, we can only do, the space shuttle does 18,000 miles an hour.
So now you're telling me we've got a energy source and a propulsion
That's
system.
What Dr. Van Lanningham told me. So
all right.
He said the studies were being done at the University of Wisconsin at Madison into ion to anti-proton propulsion systems. And based on the two criteria that NASA needed, propulsion and an energy source, James Fletcher approaches Congress, this is late 80s, asks for the funding to complete the reactor. They turned him down.
Why?
It's a really amazing story, but he ends up...
Amaze me. I mean, if something is that good, why would you turn it down?
It's amazing. And even at that time period, I believe in the last days of Howard Hughes' life, he was very close to signing the check himself, but in fact, he read it personally, but never got around to signing it before he died. Every investor, I had a company, well, firstly, I, in 1992, was appointed as director of the L.A. Tesla Foundation, and under that foundation, we were promoting scientific discoveries for a better environment. I was invited to speak in Congress in 93, which is, you know, Clinton Gore's reign, and we spoke in Congress with a handful of some of the most brilliant physicists in this country to a panel that was only 50% present. Harry Hamlin, the actor from L.A. Law, was there, and he personally was trying to get Gore to sit in on the hearings, Al Gore. And Al Gore didn't even want to come to the hearings. No one, hardly anyone showed up. We made our speech, and we were turned down again.
Why?
Well, this
he
is
says,
where it gets really, really, really quite wicked. In the Tesla Foundation, I was asked by Dr. Magwitch to do fundraising with all the oil companies and all the, you know, the philanthropy foundations. And I remember being on the phone with Royal Dutch Shell, and I got the most intimidating person on the phone. He was saying, "You do not want to continue and pursue this any longer."
David? Here's where I stop and ask you, if you're going to fundraise for a new energy source that's going to put the oil companies in the crapper,
in the crapper.
Maybe the oil companies wouldn't be the first ones you'd approach for funding, or would I be off base?
Well, actually, to protect their investment as a hedge, they better.
Well,
you know, if they're...
So you mix in a little blackmail.
You mix in a little blackmail, but this guy was... He wouldn't let me get off the phone. I mean, this man was basically telling me he could ruin my life.
Really?
And I was like, excuse me, sir, but I respect that you don't want to fund this, but I have to, you know, get off the phone. And he would not let me get off the phone. He wanted me to understand who they were, and he was so... His authority was so beckoning with power...
Do you realize who you're talking
exactly.
to, son?
It was just like that. And I was so terrified. I was like, oh, my God, can I just get off the phone now? I don't want to talk to you anymore.
You and your family are at dire risk.
Exactly.
Do you realize that, Mr. Sarita? You want to really keep talking to me about this? That kind of thing?
Look what happened to our friend Eugene Malov, whom I also had many conversations.
Well, we're not sure what happened in the murder of Dr. Malov. We don't know.
We really don't know. But it is whether I often think it was, if it was an accident or a coincidence, is it a psychic level that he was being attacked where you know, physical beings intervened on the dark side, or was it a real hit job where the CIA or whoever.
We don't know. But
we don't know.
We sure know it was a murder.
But it's one thing I'll tell you about cold fusion, and this is a concern for national security, and Hoagland brought the point up but didn't finish it, and that is that cold fusion, deuterium-deuterium, is 3.67 MeV, but 33% radioactive neutrons. And when you have a radioactive neutron source, you can use it to potentially breed plutonium from uranium. But I don't know if the neutrons are strong enough in cold fusion, 3.67 MeV. It would take an awfully long time, but you could probably do it. And that would mean it would pose a security threat for terrorism. You wouldn't want a rogue nation learning how to build one of these and having their own neutron source. But with helium-3, there are no neutrons. There's no gamma rays. There's no X-rays. There's nothing other than pure energy.
Well, you know who heads up CSETI, right?
Who what?
Who heads up CSETI?
Seth Shostak, or who's the head of it?
No, that's SETI.
Yeah.
CSETI is what I'm referring to.
Oh, yeah, right.
Dr. Greer.
Sure.
Dr. Greer is looking for somebody just like you, or with claiming to have the kind of technology that you claim you have, David. He's looking desperately for someone like that. Why have you not gone to Dr. Greer?
Well, I'm going to tell you an amazing story about...
That we'll have to hold for the break.
Okay.
Stay right where you are. Amazing story coming up.